Hello, everybody. J.J. Cooper, Jacob Runder, Baseball America College Podcast. Jacob, great to see you. Haven't seen you for a few days. So this is kind of our chance to catch up and catch up by talking college baseball, something we both love. And by the way, this is our chance to catch up. This is a chance for our listeners to catch up. And then there's going to be a little bit of a gap here where, you know, take a little break, but I'll kick it over to you for that.
Yeah, I don't like to go away often, but in some situations, that is what is required. I have made the decision to get married.
I'm going to clean up here. I'm cleaning up already. This is not required. This is a good reason to be going away, but it's there not required. It's a awesome thing that you get to go away for.
Indeed. So I have been married. I'm recording this podcast already post marriage. And then my wife and I are going to go on a honeymoon. So we're excited for that. We will be away for a little bit, which means that our college content will be either away or just dramatically limited relative to its normal flow. Go ahead.
Veteran coaches, please don't pass away. You know, I'm here on, like, Skip Bertman died and I wrote that up, but that's,
we don't want any of those. So everybody, you know, to put it out, JJ did, stay alive. Don't do anything crazy. And I'll see everybody here in a couple weeks. But in seriousness, yes, you can expect this podcast. You're listening to this. We're staying on our podcast schedule every other week. This follows that. And then we will be back with another podcast in 2 weeks. And then as far as written content goes, first week of September is when we're going to really get things going again with fall ball content.
I do want, and I'll just like say with that, like, it's been a while now, but I mean, obviously Skip Bertman's passing is very significant in the world of college baseball. You know, it's been unfortunately, between him and Anderson in Minnesota, it's been unfortunate that way this summer. But at the same time, just an acknowledgement of like that Skip Bertman is, if you're doing a Mount Rushmore of college coaches, I think he very clearly goes on it. The run that LSU did in basically a little over 10 years is in an era where, again, this is not denigrating what USC did or anything, but in an era that was much more competitive, a much different format for the postseason, to win five titles like that is truly remarkable. But we are here today to look ahead and to talk about what's coming, which is fall ball. Even though if I stick my hand outside right now, it does not tell me that fall ball is right around the corner. I think it has cooled down today here where I am in North Carolina to feels like 100. But fall ball is not far away. And I think kind of with this, like, we have a significant change this year, a couple of them, but probably the one that fans will notice the most is there are going to be more external exhibitions going on, but there's other things as well. What should fans be getting ready, getting excited about with fall ball right around the corner?
Yeah, I mean, the big one, as you just said, is the change in the amount of games that teams are able to play. Previously, college baseball teams at the Division I level were able to play two external exhibitions. So we'll give an example. If you're UCLA, you can play any school. You can play, let's say, Fullerton and Irvine. They play Irvine every year. You can play two of those games. And interestingly, there are no rules. Well, there are some rules, but they're very loose, and how teams interpret them kind of varies as far as how many innings you play. So you could host a team, like if you're UCLA and you bring in Fullerton, you can play 16 innings or 20 innings that day.
One game.
And break it up into games, right? And that's just how it works. But you can basically have, or previously you were able to have, 2 days of games against outside teams. That number has now expanded to 4. It's something that coaches have been pushing for a very long time. And we're going to talk about it here in a second, but in the 34-man roster era, where teams are getting smaller relative to what they were in the immediate post-COVID world, this is the preference. Teams want to be able to play more games against outside competition so that they have guys who can go out there and get valuable reps and not really have to overextend some of their players due to the shortages that can occur with a smaller roster.
If someone has not been paying as close of attention, you mentioned the 34-man rosters. That's a very significant change, and one that has kind of been coming. Yeah, I would say in some ways, you know, like this has kind of been the train coming down the tracks, and something that a lot of coaches have kind of worried about because pitching injuries, especially if you're doing inner squads and all that. But I want to kind of back it up a little bit, explain to people how different that is, if you would, as the 34 player roster that we have now, as compared to what would it have been a few years ago going into fall ball.
Yeah. So it's probably better that we start further back even than that. Let's go back to pre-pandemic college baseball. The 34 man roster system has been in place. This is a return to what was, not a new rule. We once were in a world where 11.7 scholarships and 34 players on your roster ruled the world. Then the pandemic happens in 2020 and the NCAA comes out and says, out of fairness to the players who had their seasons cut short, everybody, blanket waiver, freshman, sophomore, junior, senior, doesn't matter. You get one more year of eligibility. So 2020 does not count. You can come back to school in 2021 regardless. And if you were a freshman, for example, who debuted in 2020, you basically now have all four of your years back together. So freshmen stayed freshmen in 2021. In response to doing that, there was a roster exemption handed out that effectively allowed teams to do whatever they wanted when it came to having rosters that were massive. You could have 50 players, you could have 34, you could have 40, and there were tons of teams that fell into this very wide range. And as we've moved further and further from COVID, the NCAA has, understandably, rolled back some of its COVID-era roster exemptions to get closer to the 34-man roster. So now, where do we exist on this timeline? The rule is 34. The problem is that there are new factors that are introducing more players into the player pool in a similar fashion to what the pandemic did to college baseball. The NCAA has moved to a 5-year eligibility system, age-based eligibility, which keeps guys around for one more extra year. We're seeing guys who had graduated in 2026 who were not initially expected to be grandfathered into this system, winning lawsuits left and right and getting injunctions and troves to basically be able to play again. So the player pool is as well stocked as it's ever been. The rule right now is that teams need to be at 34 men on their roster by December 1st of every year. But as is the case with everything NCAA these days, there is an exception to exceptions, and we will basically see that fluctuate throughout the country. But the general rule, if you're trying to catch up with where college baseball is at, is 34 men by December 1st.
The key thing there is December 1st, though, then, because for all this talk about it, then it's not really 34 for fall ball.
No. Well,
because this is one of the things I would say, just speaking honestly, like I think has always been a flaw of this, is if you go back even before pandemic, fall ball in some ways is tryouts. It always has been, which is there are players who are there in fall. And if you perform poorly, there have been players who have found that there is not room for them come January, right?
Yes. I would say that, however, the December 1st deadline does keep you post fall ball. There are not teams that are playing fall ball into December. You're getting too close to preseason camp. So
it's different. I'm saying there was talk of having a first day that you walk on campus, like first day of fall could have been the 34 day.
That never took hold just because I think that there were a number of people who basically said, if you squeeze it all the way to the start of school, you're going to put a lot of student athletes in bad positions, which is obviously not the goal here. Or, you know, you would think that's not the goal here. I think that sometimes it's hard to tell. But right now, the rule is that by December 1st, you have to have your roster declared. I also think it's important to mention the main caveat to this. There have been athletes over the last couple of years, as we've trimmed down to this 34-man roster system, who are, I don't want to call them the beneficiary because it's not really that, but they are on the receiving end of basically what's the term is designated student athlete. And if you get the DSA tag, you don't count. If you got the DSA tag, you don't count against your team's roster limits, but you are eligible still for athletic compensation. So you can still be on a scholarship. You can still be on the roster. You can still play in the games. You can still be every member of the team that you were before. The difference is that you don't count towards a 34-man roster because that is the cut that occurred, you know, as we transitioned into the 34-man. And the NCAA did not want for some of the student athletes, instead of them being an actual cut and then having nowhere to go, they were basically symbolically cut and handed this DSA tag, which made them a roster exemption. Those will go away eventually as we phase those out. You will need to be back at 34 men. I think that is a goalpost that will constantly stay moving, to be perfectly honest, because with more eligibility comes more players, comes fewer opportunities. And so I do think that we're going to continue to see this adjust. But again, the operating procedure right now is that it is December 1st, 34 men, or 34 men plus your designated student athletes, which are players. Those guys are known already. We know 34
players. I will not specify. 34 players. Olivia Pichardo been on a roster and is female. So 34 players.
That's true.
Okay. We're going to talk a lot more about this fall ball and what is going to be the impact of these expanded external scrimmages right after this quick break.
It's time to remind everyone why baseball is glorious, especially nowadays where you could think your team is out of it, but they might be back in it again. Let me introduce you to the American League Wildcard, KP, and let's tell everyone why they might need to head back to SeatGeek, grab some more tickets for what is a playoff race before the playoffs actually begin.
Well, speaking about being out of it, I'm an American League East guy, and I'm talking to you Toronto fans. I'm talking to you Baltimore fans. A couple weeks ago, probably not a reason to come out to the games. Look at the standings right now. Both of you teams are right back in this wildcard race.
Rangers fans, we can go on and on. Mariners fans, you might be feeling a little queasy, but you're still in this thing too. So all of you should head to SeatGeek and get yourself 10% off your next set of MLB tickets. 10% off MLB tickets with the promo code Territory10. Make sure you click the link in the description to download the app and have the code automatically added to your account so that you can use it later.
So Jacob, we've gone from 2 to 4. Four external, which as you just said, can be, you could really play 80 innings if you wanted to in those four exhibitions. You know, it's, you imagine the, you know, imagine the 1979, whatever it was, Rochester game over and over kind of thing, you know, where it's like the longest games ever. But what is for coaches, what is the impact of this? And what are they kind of like, is this something that they feel like is going to kind of change fall ball?
So they do. And again, I said this earlier, but I want to reiterate, this has been something that college coaches have been looking for. They've wanted to be able to play more games against external competition in the fall. For college coaches, as I'm sure you can imagine, if you've played football at a serious level, if you've played basketball, if you've played any sport really at any serious level, you know that your coach takes these training camp seasons very seriously. This is a competitive time. As JJ said earlier, there's a tryout element for the back of a roster that really matters during the fall. The more games you get to play, especially against outside competition, where it's easier maybe to compete, it's easier for your athletes to kind of feel the competitive environment, you do learn something about your players. So from a pure, you know, understanding your roster and being able to put together a team standpoint, more games is better. And that's universally agreed upon. The other thing that I think is very important is exactly the impact of having 34 guys on your team. 34 players means that there are fewer, by nature of math, there are fewer players at your disposal to be able to run an intra-squad scrimmage. So if I have 14 pitchers on my roster, teams have more, but let's say I have 14 pitchers on my roster, you're going to get through that 14 a heck of a lot quicker than when you used to have 18 or 20 or 21 or 22. So coaches basically view it this way. If we can insert more external scrimmages, we don't have to have our pitchers face our batters. We don't get through our roster of arms as quickly if we're not using our arms to get through these games. So external means that you're not spinning your wheels. I think that the training gets a little bit more impactful just because you get to actually space guys out and have them throw on a semi-normal schedule. Without, you know, really digging too deep into your
reserves. Explain that a little bit for, because that's something I think it may be a little hard to understand. Like, okay, so how, if you're like talking about from a pitching staff perspective and scheduling it in fall ball, how would it be different now that you have these extra kind of, and generally weekend. I mean, like, that's generally when these are played, right? Like, this is not always, yeah. but generally these weekend exhibition games. How does that change? Like, if you're a pitcher, how is your workload going to be different with this?
So, well, let's first talk about the college season. If you've never watched college baseball before, there is a difference between what happens with a rotation at the professional level versus what happens in a rotation at the college level. If you're a pro pitcher, you're pitching once every 5 days in a five-man rotation. It's grueling. You're constantly
six.
On the
every
clock.
Once every 6 days.
Right, every 6 days because of an off day. Right.
In college like baseball, five guys going to go, so you go what they want, and then
In college baseball, you're pitching once a week. If you're a Friday guy in college, you're pitching on Fridays. If you're a Saturday guy, you're pitching on Saturdays. Rotations will evolve. They will change throughout the year. But generally speaking, in a perfect world, a rotation does not change and you pitch on 1 week's rest. It's a three-man rotation instead of five. Teams only have to cover the weekends and midweeks. Some teams, if they have ample depth, will have a designated midweek starter that will go every week on Tuesdays or Wednesdays. Most teams, generally speaking, most teams will have a group of players who will start midweek games, and it's like your own midweek rotation. Guys who will come in once a week, but still, you're basically pitching on 1 week's rest. The slight difference is that relievers, good relievers, will occasionally be midweek starter types or midweek value arms, and those guys will then pitch again over the weekend. So you could see somebody start on a Tuesday and then come in out of the bullpen over the weekend. We'll call those players the swingmen and exceptions. Generally, you're on 1 week's rest if you're a starter. In this system right now, if you have four games there in the fall, there is a much more reasonable path to getting your pitchers on that 1 week schedule, which is something that coaches really want to do. There are relievers that will go out and they will pitch more often than that for the reasons that we just talked about. They're relievers. But starting pitchers, if you have four games spread across a month or 6 weeks, you can line your guys up basically so that their outings get them in on a 1 week rest ahead of an external scrimmage, which is where you're going to extract the most value.
Okay. So that's kind of be a key thing here because teams are going to get to test. And to be honest, it's also for players. It is more enjoyable to play someone else than it is to be just playing against your teammates over and over all fall. So that's obviously that. But I kind of the other question with this is like, I do feel like that there's also a promotional and a baseball interest component to this as well. We've seen teams do this, not surprisingly, especially around the SEC, where you can kind of tie this into kind of your fall schedule as well, as far as other, you know, football and other events where, you know, we've seen, for instance, Georgia and Florida play an exhibition game in advance of Georgia, Florida before and things like that, where there are kind of, is this also got a chance to be a little bit more of building interest for spring for fans in fall now that you have these more exhibition games?
There's no doubt about that. I think that there are aspects of this that are beneficial and mirror college baseball's trajectory. We've talked about this a lot on the college podcast over the course of the last year. College baseball is trending in a great direction. Like, I don't think that there's anybody that would tell you right now that college baseball is in any sort of lull. It's really picking up from a fan interest standpoint. It's picking up from a viewership standpoint on TV. And while these games aren't televised, which I think is an important part of this as well, like you're not watching this on TV. But if you live in one of these cities or if you're visiting one of these cities, now you have four opportunities to go watch college baseball in person. And by the way, that's on the cheap. Most of these schools are not charging, you know, in-season ticket prices to be able to get in. And I can tell you with certainty that there are a lot of schools that don't charge you a penny to be able to go watch these games. So when you may have to go pay to go watch college baseball in season if you want to go in person, you can go watch your team play 14, 15, 16, 18, 20 innings against a team.
Or as many of those innings as you want to watch before you're like, I'm good for the day.
Right. Well, you could be crazy like me and you could sit there through all 20. You could be a normal person. You could watch 7, 8, or 9 innings and get out of there. But the bottom line is it's cheap, it's accessible, and now there's more of them. And people will have access to watching fall ball. And I think that we've also seen teams really embrace that as well. Like, for example, Auburn will play Mississippi State on October 9th. Those are two fan bases that are not going to miss that game. Like, it doesn't count for anything necessarily, but you're telling me that two rabid SEC fan bases in Auburn and Mississippi State are not going to go on and figure out who's going to win this fall ball exhibition and cheer loudly as their team takes the field because it matters so much to them. And you're telling me that some of the losing team's fans aren't going to go into full-on meltdown about what their team's going to look like or be like, or whether or not they're ahead or behind schedule. Like, this will contribute to the excitement of the season. I think that this builds anticipation and kind of forces fans to think about college baseball earlier and in a more serious way than maybe they would have last year.
Complaining about bullpen usage and who was in the right role and not in the 15th inning of a game, you know, kind of thing.
Yeah.
Lots to look forward to there.
You're 20 innings into a game, the sun has set, it's 10 p.m. and cooling, and you're freaking out about which freshman reliever is coming into the game and the decision that your coach made. So I'm looking forward to seeing that, and I think that everybody should, give their coaches hell. Make them hear it.
So, okay. The main thing, though, that we also want to dive into is how much does this – is this something that is interesting and then should be quickly forgotten, or is there real value to insights that can be gleaned from fall ball? We'll get into that right after this quick break. Okay, so Jacob, we've got these four exhibitions, you know, now. We've got fall ball all around the country. Most important thing, the job that you have, one of the jobs you have, is to figure out, okay, does this matter? How much does this matter? So I'll ask you, how much does this matter?
So we just talked about it from the team perspective. For them, it matters a ton. From the scouting perspective, which is where we're going to go with this right now, I think it's a mixed bag. And we're going to go into why. We talked about this a little bit off air before the show. But there is a double-edged sword when it comes to watching exhibition baseball in the fall. On one hand, and this is particularly true for bats, there is an opportunity to see very simply who got bigger, who didn't get bigger, who's faster, who maybe has changed their swing, who's changed some of their mechanics on the mound, who's added a pitch. Things that are very basic and easy to observe that require truly no evaluation. Notice that I did not say, did player X add a pitch and is it good? No, that's not the question. The question is, did player X add a pitch? Yes or no. Did player X change his swing? Yes or no. Is he visibly bigger and stronger? Or has he looked maybe like he's been in better shape before? Did he come back to campus a little bit overweight, which happens all the time? Those are questions. Those are yes or no questions that with your eyes, you can go out there and answer. There is objectively value to that. Every year, and you'll see it at Baseball America starting in a couple of weeks when we really get going with fall reports, we will write about who looks bigger, stronger, faster, swing change, different pitch, mechanical change. You will see it. Where it becomes a little bit more murky, especially with pitchers, is the second non-yes or no portion of that question. Did it get better? Is the pitch a good pitch, yes or no? Are these mechanics suitable for this pitcher? Is this pitcher's velocity in the fall a concern, or is this, you know, a harbinger of things to come? So those things are harder to glean, in my opinion, in the fall. I know a whole bunch of scouts and coaches who love going and sitting in empty stands for fall ball practices and watching batting practice or watching a bullpen or watching an intra-squad scrimmage, and they take a ton away from it. They write copious notes, they're going to go home, and that will be the start of their file, the foundation of their file for a player as they lead up to the draft. For a lot of others, and this is kind of where I stand on it, I think that you have to be a little bit selective. For a bat, I think that there is a really easy path to going and watching a ton of ABs in the fall and saying, this guy is stronger, he's going to be able to access more power, we're seeing a swing change that's going to be beneficial. Player X struggled big time with off-speed pitches the year before because he was getting too steep in his swing. Well, the swing is a little bit more on plane. He's making better swing decisions. It seems like there's some momentum that occurred over the summer that's translated into the fall. I think that you can very comfortably look at that and take that away. Daniel Jackson was the guy last year where that very much happened for us. Daniel Jackson was a very undisciplined, very chase-prone bat in his first year at Georgia after transferring from Wofford. He gets to campus. There were signs in the fall, but there was a lot of swing and miss. He accessed the power occasionally, but the hit tool was so far behind that he wasn't really able to get there. He comes back in the fall, and all of a sudden, there's this different player. The swing has evolved a little bit. The swing decisions have evolved a ton, and the buzz starts to happen, whether it was from, you know, conversations with Wes Johnson, whether it was us going and seeing him in person, where it was apparent that this was somebody who was on breakout watch. And notice, again, breakout watch.
Not a warning.
Not a warning. We're not calling
it. Tornado's not on the ground. The conditions are favorable for a creation of. The player is not a star. The conditions are favorable for him to take a step forward.
Exactly. And if you go back to look to read some of our writing from last fall at Baseball America, I think you'll notice, and there's value in that, just because you'll know kind of what we're targeting when it comes to fall ball observations. We had written pretty explicitly, these are the things he needs to continue to do in order to be good. But we knew what those things were because of his fall ball performance. On the pitching side, and you may disagree with this, on the pitching side, I think it's much, much tougher to draw similar conclusions. Why? If you have a sophomore who contributed for the first time in a serious way in the spring, in 2026, then he goes out and he plays in the Cape Cod League, and he stays there for, you know, 20 innings, 10 outings, and then he goes home. So he's thrown the most innings he's ever thrown in the spring. He's thrown an additional 20 innings over the summer. He gets back to campus. The arm has been shut down for a short period, and then he starts to throw again. The velocity's down. The spin capacity is not quite the same, and things just look, for a lack of better terms, tired. That is much harder to separate between warning or, you know, projecting, because the workload and the spreading out of that workload can be challenging for pitchers who have never experienced it before. I have seen many an arms who have gone out in the fall, looked just okay, if not poor, and then they come out 3 months later in the spring, and it's like, whoa, that's the guy that we were expecting. Mm-hmm. It happens all the time. I think that it happens disproportionately relative to bats.
And there's the flip side too, which is sometimes you will hear of a guy who's, all of a sudden we're seeing 97s, 98s from this guy or whatever. And then the season rolls around and it's like, it's not there anymore. Like,
right.
Yeah, unfortunately, there are guys who they peak in fall ball sometimes, and that's not when you want to peak. But, you know, again, there is real information there, but you just have to know, as I say, I agree with you, that you have to know that all we're looking though, I mean, like, again, the best way I put it is every season, even if you said you're just watching practice before the season starts, come January and February, and you said, who are going to be the players who step forward? You'll get a lot of those right. But coaches will tell you that sometimes they have a guy who they think they're going to really depend on come opening weekend, and it just goes completely off, you know, the wrong way, or vice versa, where there's a guy who you're like, you come into the season thinking is never going to play for you and ends up being a key contributor. Like, this is all of this is within realms of probability, not certainty.
Of course. And I also think that, you know, it's important for us to talk about it the other way too, especially when it comes to pitchers. Last year, and you know, Georgia was a great example of this on multiple fronts, but last year, this was also around the time of year that we had a conversation with Wes Johnson, who was like, listen, I know what Joey Volchko has looked like in the past at Stanford, but this is a whole new pitcher now who has reinvented himself, and here are the things that we've done tangibly that we can show you on video to prove that there have been changes. I'll give you an even deeper poll, like Zach Crotchfeldt with Troy. Zach Crotchfeldt has had a rough go of it throughout his college career. Multiple stops, multiple transfers, nothing really figured it out, nothing really clicked. Then he gets to Troy, and all of a sudden, the velocity comes on in the fall. They add a more refined version of his slider, which really suited him well. And all of a sudden, they've developed this pitcher who is really starting to look effective, and the stuff is looking different than it has in the past. And to your point, yes, that there's fool's gold in that. Like, sometimes guys will go out, and you're going to see the 96s and 97s and these short burst fall outings, and they come out in the spring and they're never the same guy. On the flip side of the coin, though, there are plenty of guys who will go out in the fall and they'll show it to you, and then they're going to come out in the spring and they're going to do it again. So there is something to be said for seeing what somebody's done to make adjustments, seeing the changes. I'll give you a really high profile example. Jackson Flora struggled his entire college career with Andrew Checkets, who is like the premier mid-major pitching developer. There are few, if any, who are better. And Jackson Flora, for whatever reason, could not develop a changeup. He tried multiple grips. They ran through a splitter. They ran through a true changeup. They've gone through everything. Circle changeup, the works. And nothing clicked for Jackson Flora. And all of a sudden, Andrew Checkets is like, all right, you know, changeup number 8 is we're going to go to the kick changeup. And throughout the fall, this kick changeup is like, oh, that's pretty good. Oh, that's really good. Hey, that could be a plus pitch if it looks like that when the lights are on and the games matter. And sure enough, the plus pitch that existed in the fall translates to the spring, and it gets to this point where the conversation by the time the draft rolls around is he has a reliable changeup in his arsenal. So changes do occur that you can put some stock into. This is us basically telling you not the time to buy in. Probably a time to just put it in your notes and take notice. And then when it rolls around in the spring again, when preseason camp, you know, kicks off, and if it looks the same, that's when you can kind of start to put the puzzle back together and say, we saw it when we knew when this was coming because it existed a little bit in the fall.
Okay. I'll ask one more kind of summarize of that, which is from a purely practical standpoint, something fans may very much be interested in. How much do you think our preseason college top 25, where it stands now, how much of that will change based on fall ball? Obviously, I would say that no one's going to go from, well, we didn't have them in the top 25 coming into the fall ball, and now they're top 5. It's not going to be something like that. But how much can teams move up and down or move on based on what you're hearing, what you're seeing, you know, all your reporting from fall ball?
Yeah, I think that it matters. Everything matters. Like, there's no data that we're going to get. And when I say data, I don't mean like actual raw data. I just mean like information. Mm-hmm. There is no information that we're going to get that's not a factor. When we go watch a fall ball exhibition and we see a pitcher, you know, look great, who wasn't a factor last year, who's a transfer, and they show us something, that doesn't just go away. Like, we're not dismissing anything. That will stick in our heads. Information that we get from coaches matters when it comes to projecting what their teams will look like. If we have, you know, a high vote of confidence from a coach in a transfer outfielder who we weren't so sure about, and then we have some conversations with scouts who are like, yeah, that guy's actually pretty good, that will move the needle, you know, ever so slightly in any direction. Is the fall going to influence how we do our top 25? Not a ton. I think more now in the transfer era than maybe, and this predates me, but I would imagine that if I was at BA when the transfer portal was not a thing, the fall would matter a lot less to my preseason top 25 than it does now. But there are at a number of different very high level schools that will be factors. Players who were at much, much, much lower level schools a year ago who were playing, like, here's an example. UCLA has taken on, actually, you know what? Let's go non-team specific. I think this is a better theme kept broad. Many teams have taken on players from conferences where the average fastball, for example, is an 87 to 88 mile per hour pitch. That is way, way below what you're going to face if you're now in the SEC, if you're now in the ACC or the Big 12 or the Big 10 or the Sun Belt. When that player steps foot on the field for the first time in the fall and he sees 91 on average and he sees somebody come out of the bullpen who is 98 to 100, where in the SEC you will see that, mm-hmm. we're going to know real quick about whether or not you're capable of handling that. And that's not to say that players can't evolve. They can and do. But generally speaking, if you're going to come out and look overmatched against the velocity that you're going to be facing in the season – and we were expecting you to look a whole lot better, what's going to happen, JJ? We're going to roll back our predictions. If there was a player at a major school that was going to be a factor in our top 25 that we were like, okay, this is a heart of the order type bat that this team is relying on to replace major production, and then that player goes out in the fall and it's like, well, he cannot touch 96 and up. I mean, he is just he can't touch it at all. What are we going to do? We're going to, you know, adjust our expectations. So to tie the whole thing together, we are very careful. We don't want to read too much into the fall because it's very hard to glean true value from games that don't matter and in a part of the calendar that is challenging to be at your best. But at the same time, we ignore nothing. So everything is information, and it does matter to answer your question.
So the other thing that could be going on this fall, we saw it last year, is a little bit of a different time of year coaching carousel, right? Especially with mid-majors. We saw that last year. Do we expect to see that again this year, or could it be a little different?
Well, first let me explain what JJ is talking about. Last year, for the first time in to this level, we saw a number of college coaches leave their post. This is assistants, several head coaches left their jobs to go take jobs with MLB teams. We saw, for example, Lamar's pitching coach, took a job with the Nationals. Eastern Michigan's head coach took a job as a minor league coordinator, I believe, with the Red Sox. So like these coaches are basically leaving to go and take front office or player development jobs at the pro level, for mostly because they are disillusioned with the current state of the college game. And we had several coaches last year who basically told us as much. Like they were looking for jobs outside of the college baseball space, because being in college baseball in this era is way too much of a headache and the juice is not worth the squeeze. So you can still go and be a part of the baseball world and advance your career, but you go and do it with the pros and you have, you know, a third of the headache and for the same amount of money with the same amount of career development. So we are seeing a willingness that didn't exist a couple years ago from some of these coaches to go and consider pro jobs. When do those pro jobs happen? You better can answer this than I can, but generally speaking, late September kind of through December is the window for teams to hire.
Generally, contracts for on-field personnel and front office personnel run on to the end of the season, like October, you know, at the end of October, really generally end of October, and then you're on new contract for the next year. There are teams that do a little different. There's some as late as December, but so that is kind of your window, is that right when basically, right when we're wrapping up fall ball, it's like, and again, teams that do this right generally tell the people who aren't going to be welcome back well in advance to give them time to kind of start trying to find the next spot as well. So you have this kind of going on, this churn happening where teams know they have openings, where people are looking for jobs, kind of starting, you know, really, we'll wrap up the season in September on the minor league side. And then right after that, that's when you kind of kick into this, which is what we just said, the time for fall ball. But there is a little bit of a complicating factor this year.
Yeah.
Which is, so we just said, these are, you know, if you are under contract, right? If you are a front office official, if you are a coach and you're under contract, generally, and I'd say generally, but generally, whether there's a lockout or not is not going to affect whether you get paid because you're under contract. But if you're not under contract, that's a different story. Now, again, we saw during COVID, there were furloughs and all that. But again, speaking in generalities, so there are teams I've heard that are, you know, there are rumors at least that there are some teams who are very much may kind of across the board be much slower about contracts this year because, hey, if we're going to lock out, you know, we want you back. We're going to welcome you back, but we're going to wait until this all gets cleared up because our owner doesn't want to pay people if there's no baseball going on, all that, which again, but even though the minors will go on. So what I say though is I'll kind of kick it back to you. Like there's a little bit more uncertainty. There may be a little bit slower job market on the pro side this year. But two parts I want to ask you. One is that, like, how much that may affect it. But two, when you said, like, there's a disillusionment. We said this about mid-majors mainly. Is that really come down to, like, I've had not nearly as many conversations as you have, but I've talked to mid-major coaches who I would describe their disillusionment is they feel like it's always, again, this has never been a fair game, right? This has never been a game where all 300-plus teams right. are all competing on the same, you know, with the same resource and all that. But is this disillusionment kind of tied to the current structure that they just feel like that they have less chance to compete.
That's it. Yeah. And I think that there's several factors to that that are really important. The first of which is the transfer portal. If you are a coach at, you know, Eastern Michigan, it's much harder for you to retain your best player than it is for LSU and Jay Johnson to retain their best player. And that reality, the constant re-recruitment of your roster, when you're losing players to the transfer portal, it really does mean that you're doing something right. Because if you're bringing in players who are good enough to move up the ladder, it means that you were the one who discovered these under-recruited guys who are now going to go and be serviceable SEC or ACC players. If you're constantly losing those guys, and you know, because the proof is in the transfer, you know that you're doing the right thing. You're on the right guys. You are a good evaluator. And then when you make those good evaluations, you have 1 year, basically, a one-year window every year to be good enough to compete before you lose that player who's going to go and move up because you literally cannot afford them. That is, in the words of several coaches who I've talked to about this, that's out of your control entirely. And when you lose control over the situation, it becomes very easy to sit there and go, I can't do anything about this. I can't make this situation better. Therefore, I'm spinning my wheels. And so it's better for me to go and advance my career in a place where I don't need to go spin my wheels, where I can go and be a good evaluator or recruiter or whatever word you want to use to describe it and actually see the fruits of that labor without having to worry about losing players in a way that is uncontracted, in a way that's out of your control, in a way that can impact your roster. So these guys basically are realizing, some of them, that they're out of options. And so you either are doing it because you love the game and you're okay with that. And I'm going to name one person here because he and I have talked about it, and there's a story about it at Baseball America that you can go read. But Reggie Christensen at Sacramento State. Reggie Christensen is an example of a coach who has really embraced the modern realities of being a mid-major coach. Reggie has been explicit that when he brings in a player who then transfers and goes and has tons of success in the SEC, good example, Golden Spikes winner Vahiva Aloy was a Sacramento State Hornet to start his career. He then transfers to Arkansas. He wins the Golden Spikes in his draft year. And what does Sacramento State do within 5 minutes of the announcement that he won? They post this lovely graphic that basically says, hey, are you a high schooler who wants to win the Golden Spikes? Come and start your career at Sacramento State. And whatever happens after that, happens after that. But if you want to have a chance, you want to be a Hornet to start, just like Vahiva Aloy did, because it worked for him and it can work for you. Reggie Christensen has embraced that. He's open about it. He talks about it. He talks about it when he recruits players and their families. There is no hard feelings if you play at Sacramento State and you go on to have a bigger, better, whatever you want to call it, career.
They count you as a success story.
You are a Hornet success story for sure. You are a Hornet alum, and part of your career, as Reggie sees it, is that you are a Sacramento State player. There are other coaches, who I will not name, who look at it very much the opposite way. There are mid-major coaches who see their players as their players until they're not. And once they transfer, there are hard feelings, and it does hurt these guys to see their players go. And they don't embrace it necessarily as aggressively as somebody like Reggie Christensen, who has kind of made that a partial mantra operating procedure for Sacramento State. And it's those guys who are a little bit more willing, I think, right now to explore a future with MLB and trying to be in a position where they don't have to worry about the transfer portal or having their roster poached and picked apart. So it's all a matter of acceptance. Everything is in the eye of the beholder. But I do think that, you know, with transfer portal shenanigans becoming more prevalent with every year that passes, we will see more coaches at least consider the pro route. How a potential lockout or team's reluctance to issue contracts right now, how that impacts it remains to be seen. I don't have a prediction, just because I don't know that anybody truly knows what's coming over the next couple months, if not year. But I do think that, you know, in a world where contracts are still being handed out as they normally would be, we will continue to see the number of mid-major and low-major coaches who leave for pro ball increase year to year.
And we should note that there's also, we've seen going on the other way in season, even actually at the MLB level. We saw multiple minor league coordinators, coaches leave affiliated, you know, minor leagues, you know, teams to join colleges in the kind of summer typical. So we should say this is kind of a cross-pollination thing. There are coaches who are going from pro ball to college, and there are coaches who are going from college to pro ball. And I would say more than anything that this is an era where those on-ramps and off-ramps run both ways. This is not something where if you take this off-ramp and you go into pro ball, you're never getting back to college. Or if you go to college baseball, if you're in college baseball, you can never get to pro ball. That is not the world that we live in now.
No, I mean, you can even accelerate that to the most notable examples of it. Tony Vitello last year took a job at the end of fall ball that made him the San Francisco Giants manager. And I think that there are a lot of people right now who would tell you that they wouldn't be surprised if Tony Vitello in the next couple of years ends up back in a college dugout. Your doors don't close right now in baseball. I think that everything is viewed as another step in your development. Like if you're going to go and be a pro scouting coordinator, or you're going to go and be, you know, whatever it is, player development, catching coordinator, I know is a position that a couple of guys have really considered over the last year or so, minor league catching coordinator, that is, you go and do that, you do a good job, that is a notch in your cap. And so I think that you add skills that are attractive for colleges that may be looking, you add connections, your reputation continues to evolve. So I think that it is a two-way street. There are, as you just said, there are plenty of guys on the pro side who view college as the same opportunity, that they're going to go and be a college pitching coach, and that's going to be the thing that accelerates them. Max Wiener is wildly successful in the college space right now as a pitching coach. He's been one of the best pitching coaches for the last couple of years. Where did he come from? He was the Mariners pitching coordinator, minor league pitching coordinator, and one of the youngest and most successful in the league at that. So like, this is not somebody who was failing out of the pro game and took college as a get out of jail free card. This is somebody who had a very, very bright future on the pro side, who then chose to go be a college coach. And what he does with his career in the future, we'll see. That's somebody who I think could easily be an extremely successful college head coach, just as easily as I could see him going back into pro ball and being a scouting coordinator, a scouting director even, an amateur scouting director, a pitching coordinator again. Like those are all things that I think are within Max Wiener's future. And all of that has been aided by the experiences that he's had so far. So there's no wrong path in this. It's just that the amount of options and the willingness of some of these coaches to explore them, I think, has increased in recent years.
So that is our look at fall ball. Get you ready for it, our fall ball preview. Jacob, anything we didn't cover that you're like, wait, before we run, we need to make sure we touch on that?
We are in a good spot. I think that college baseball is about to kind of get back into its flow a little bit. We've been quiet the last week or two. I think that it'll stay, you know, relatively quiet for another week or two. And then fall ball will get going, and then all the things that we just talked about will come into effect. And if you want the coverage of that, the best coverage of that, head on over to baseballamerica.com, because again, like last year, I will remind our returning readers, and I will introduce this to our new ones. We take fall ball seriously, even though you have to be careful and all the things that we just talked about. We will have very thorough breakdowns of many teams. Last year, I believe we got to 83 of Division I teams off the top of my head, and of the tournament teams last year, we covered a pretty good amount. Our goal every year is to try and hit the previous year's tournament teams, and then a couple beyond that as well. So look for those. That's our fall ball intel series. It'll get going pretty soon. We'll have, you know, between one and two of those come out every single week, and beyond that, that's pretty much it. You know, check out our pro coverage too, because you know, if you're a college baseball fan, this is kind of the time of year where some of the alums of college baseball will start to make their last second debuts and get their first looks at pro ball.
There's a lot of guys that we're writing about right now on the pro side, like, oh, Ace Reese just had a monster game. Oh, hey, Justin LeBron has three home runs in high A in a very short period of time. Rock Schlowski's missed a couple of games, but is expected back in the lineup at Winston-Salem. We've actually got Ian Kundle is there to see Rock this week. So There's a lot going on. There is a lot going on at baseballamerica.com. Do check it out. And like you said, we will be back 2 weeks from now, the next Baseball America College podcast. For Jacob, I'm JJ. So long, everybody.